Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the New Books Network. I am your host, Rob Denning. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Christopher Tomlins about his new book, In the Matter of Nat Turner, A Speculative History, which was just published in 2020 by Princeton University Press. Professor Tomlins, welcome to the show.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, and before we get into the book, can you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, I teach at the University of California, Berkeley. I teach in the law school. It happens that I'm not a lawyer by training. I'm a historian. I have a PhD from Johns Hopkins University quite a long time ago. after I left Johns Hopkins, I was looking for a job. This is right at the end of the 1970s, when history was in one of its many job crisis modes. So I ended up going to legal studies department at La Trobe University in Melbourne, in Australia, where I stayed for 13 years. And the beauty of that job was that it got me into legal studies and away from history. I continued to be a historian. In fact, I became a legal historian as a result of that move. But I was not employed as an academic historian as such in a history department. And that pretty much dictated the rest of my sort of career. After La Trobe, I returned to the U.S. to join a research foundation in Chicago, where I stayed for about 17 years. And then I moved to California to join a new law school that was created at UC Irvine. And then 5 years later, moved on to Berkeley, where there's a well-known, unique PhD program inside the law school called Jurisprudence and Social Policy. And that is the main reason I came to Berkeley, to teach in that program. So that's pretty much how I got from sort of A to B.
Okay, that's great. And your book is on the Nat Turner Rebellion, as it's kind of popularly termed. Before we get into the book itself, can you give us a reminder of what exactly happened during that rebellion? Who was Nat Turner, and what was this event?
Nat Turner was a slave. He was born in 1800, or in the early 19th century. So he was 30 years old in 1831 when the rebellion occurred. And the book is actually less about the rebellion than it's about an attempt to recover Turner himself. But what happened as a result of his leadership, his actions, was that a very small group at first of slaves came to a decision to launch an attack upon white households in the small village, really hamlet, of Cross Keys in Southampton County, Virginia. So they moved from household to household over a period of 12 hours, recruiting new slaves to join the group and killing the white inhabitants as they moved. Mostly the inhabitants were women and children. And by the end of the first afternoon, they started very early in the morning, in the early hours of the morning, and over a period of about 12 hours, killed 55 whites without losing any of their own number. And then were challenged and met by groups of local inhabitants, white militia. They retreated back toward Cross Keys, the hamlet where everything had begun, but then decided to camp out on a plantation overnight and make another attempt. They were trying to reach the town of Jerusalem, which is the county seat of Southampton County. And after that night, they attempted to move and to recruit some more supporters. They were repulsed again by whites, and the rebellion at that point essentially collapsed. Everybody fled back toward Cross Keys or to other parts of the area of Southampton County where all of this had occurred, and the group dispersed sort of chaotically.
Great, thank you for that. And we'll go into a little bit more detail, I think, as we get through the book here. Before we get to the content of the book, how did you come to write this? What got you interested in this story?
Well, I had been curious about Matt Turner for many years. I had come across Turner through reading William Styron's book, The Confessions of Matt Turner. I had also read the pamphlet, the famous pamphlet by Thomas Ruffin Gray, from which Styron basically stole his title. I had come across traces of the Turner Rebellion in other work that I had been doing, in research that I had been doing, which had touched upon parts of Virginia. So the Turner Rebellion is sort of like a rock thrown into a pond, and it's, you know, it's a splash and then ripples, and the ripples go everywhere. And so in working on some research on Virginia at that time, I had come across the effects of the rebellion. But I had never followed it up. This curiosity, this sort of acquaintance remained completely latent until 10 years ago. I had finished another book, which was a kind of big, sprawling a book about nearly half a millennium of Anglo-American history. And I decided that I wanted to try to write something more precise, more focused. And I thought, well, it's time to satisfy that curiosity about Matt Turner. So that's what took me there.
Yeah, and this is an interesting book in that you're not framing it as a full-on biography of Turner. The book title itself is In the Matter of Nat Turner, rather than, I think you point this out at one point in the book, you didn't title it just as Nat Turner Life or something like that. You titled it as In the Matter of Nat Turner, A Speculative History. What was your thinking behind that title?
Well, I couldn't pretend to write something that could be classified as a biography because there simply isn't enough material to be able to write a biography as such. The subject of the book really is sort of Nat Turner, the historical phenomenon, just as much as it is Nat Turner himself. That's the reason I called it In the Matter of Nat Turner, because it is about the phenomenon of Nat Turner as well as about the person. I call it a speculative history because I speculate, or rather I attempt to build an interpretation of Turner and of the events of his rebellion on the basis of a very close reading of really what are no more than little fragments or shards of evidence. So it's speculative not in the sense that I'm making it up. It's speculative in the sense that I'm trying to provide an intelligent and, I hope, reasonably convincing account of Turner by reading what there is to read in terms of primary evidence very, very closely, and then interpreting it very, very imaginatively, I hope.
Yeah, and I believe that you succeed at that. I mean, that is kind of an ongoing thread of the book, is that there is very little remaining information about Turner. And so you focus, you like, as you say, you do some close readings on some very selected sources. And that makes a lot of sense in this situation. You start off the book by talking about the William Styron Confessions of Nat Turner that was published in 1967, as you mentioned a few minutes ago. Why did you decide to start there rather than going back to the very beginning, right at the beginning of the book?
By starting with Styron, I'm starting with the best known attempt to create an image, a picture of Turner as a person. I also was fascinated as I read into Styron and the debates that his book caused by Styron's own inability really to articulate what he was trying to do in the book. He calls the book a meditation on history. But he is never able to explain what he means by that. And indeed, he acknowledges himself that he is unable to explain what he means by that. He says, I never really knew what I meant by that. My book is also a meditation on history. And I think that as a historian with a developed philosophy of history, I hope that I'm more successful in articulating what it means to engage in historical research and to engage in the interpretation of a historical figure like Turner. So I begin with Styron because Styron is the, I think for many people, still is the person one thinks of as the person who attempted to write about Turner, the person. And he failed, not in writing an interesting novel, but he failed in that larger attempt to explain what it meant to write about history as such. And so my goal was to use him as a kind of a stalking horse, to engage in a conversation about William Styron as an introduction to a further attempt, my own attempt to engage with Nat Turner of the person.
One of the things, other things that interested me about your discussion of Styron was that it provided you an interesting way to introduce the historiographical kind of debate that's been happening about Nat Turner, because you were able to kind of identify that Styron had his defenders among the historians, but he also had people who rejected his Styron's interpretation among historians too. And so it kind of provided an interesting entryway into the long-running historiographical debate, especially in the time of the Civil Rights Movement, that is of interest to us today, even from a historiographical perspective.
Absolutely. Styron was writing as a white author, obviously, and took it upon himself to write in the first person. So he assumed himself into the character of Nat Turner in order to write from Turner's perspective. That was his authorial conceit. That caused no end of controversy, because as many African-American critics said, there's no basis upon which, there's no experiential basis for a white author to be able to understand an African-American slave. That also had a major impact upon, you know, how Styron actually imagines the person. He's very selective in his imagination of Turner. He says, I didn't want to write about a religious fanatic. I find the person of Nat Turner that I meet in the sources that I consulted almost a sort of repulsive psychopathic figure. And so I have decided, he tells his audience, I decided to make up my own Turner with his own motivations. I gave him his motivations, he says at one point. I gave him all of his worries, his fears, his anxieties, which is a kind of somewhat arrogant statement for anybody to make about a historical personage, that instead of trying to work out as best one can the motivations, the worries, the anxieties that the personality itself, the person manifests, you just ignore all of those and make up a new set that accord better with your own sense of the kind of character you want to create. So all of this caused considerable controversy. Black intellectuals published their own group critique of Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner, and Styron in turn was then defended with great energy by any number of white historians, Eugene Genovese, for one, who climbed into this fight with great gusto, and who criticized the African-American response to Styron, as did others, perhaps a bit less vociferously. C. Van Woodward, for another, as a white historian, basically endorsed Styron as a historian, He says he gets the man right, he gets the period right. So that is part of the, you know, part of the controversy that you refer to, the historiographic controversy, is the split between African-American critics and white historians over the validity of the portrayal that Styron offers. Of course, another historiographical controversy that I guess is ongoing is to what extent can one justify or identify with someone who, after all, leads a rebellion that results in the deaths of not only 55 whites, but also an equivalent number of slaves.
Yeah, and I think that book does discussing that book provides you with a really good introduction to the historiography as you've described it, and I think that provided a really effective way to kind of introduce the reader to Nat Turner and the rebellion. One of the kind of running threads of the book is the lack of documentary evidence about the event itself. And so after your discussion of William Styron's Confessions of Nat Turner, you then jump back to the original Confessions of Nat Turner. It was published by Thomas Gray back in 1831. And that earlier document really forms the basis of the rest of your book. You mentioned the original Confessions by Gray is only 24 pages long, I believe it is, and so it requires a lot of deep reading to really be able to extrapolate to figure out what happened. So tell us about that document. What can we learn from it, and what do you think we should learn from it?
Gray's pamphlet is and remains invaluable because it is the result of at least in part, the result of a conversation or a series of conversations that Gray has with Nat Turner after he is captured and while he is in jail awaiting trial. Gray himself is someone who had taken great interest in the rebellion itself as an event. He had written about it before he wrote the pamphlet. He had written letters to Virginia newspapers about the rebellion. He had actually participated in some of the action as a member of one of the first groups of whites to confront the rebels on the afternoon of Monday, the 21st of August. The pamphlet itself is constructed in a very, it's a very comp, I think it's quite a complex document. It appears like, as you say, it's a 24-page pamphlet. It appears really quite a simple document with a preface written by Gray, then a long section that purports to be the Turner speaking to Gray in his description of himself. His description of the events of the rebellion, a further commentary by Gray that appears at the conclusion of that section that is attributed to Turner, and then a short report of the trial and sentencing that occurred on Saturday, 5th of October, Turner's trial date. It has always seemed to me that the people who have used the pamphlet have not read it with as much sort of close attention as perhaps it deserves. That is truer of historians who have basically used it as an empirical account of the rebellion than of literary scholars who are much more interested in it, in its construction as a document. And that gives them greater, I think, insight into the pamphlet as a text. And in any case, I decided to try to approach the pamphlet by analyzing its structure as well as its substance. I was following the technique suggested by structuralist literary theory in doing that. And this really requires that one pay attention to all of the component elements of a text, to see how the text is being put together, to understand the text, not simply as words on a page, that one reads as a narrative of something that has occurred, but as a document that has been constructed for a purpose. Once one looks at the pamphlet in that way, its complexity begins to become much more apparent. For example, it begins with a series of certifications that attest to its validity, its truth, its authenticity. Then proceeds to that preface written by Gray, which is really a set of instructions as to how readers should encounter the pamphlet. It then proceeds to the text of the conversation with Turner, but it does so only through setting up a series of sort of conditions which frame that conversation, which appear almost as if they are a cage containing a dangerous, unruly text that has to be controlled by the author. This kind of analysis leads me to trust that the text itself, the text of the conversation between Gray and Turner, is a relatively reliable account, not so much of the events of the rebellion itself, although they are called from Turner's perspective, but a reliable account of an autobiographical account of Turner himself. There's lots of material in the first half of the pamphlet that is completely new to Gray. He knows about the rebellion. He knows about what happened during the rebellion. He may well know more about what happened during the rebellion than Turner himself. But he doesn't know anything about Turner the person. And he learns that during the first part of the conversation. And it's that part, in fact, that I find most interesting in the pamphlet. It's that part that I find most informative, because that is the part that is essentially the most autobiographical.
And that first section, in your reading and in the way you describe it in the book, that provides you kind of a launching point to start talking about Nat Turner's conception of religion and his place in religion. So can you tell us a little bit about the religious background to that text and Turner's view of his own religion and the role that he's playing within that?
Yeah, it's no great discovery of mine that that Turner has a religious mentality. That has always been remarked upon. What I found fascinating about the religious mentality that is on display in the pamphlet, however, is that it is, in my view, far more sophisticated, far more informed, far more coherent than simply saying, well, Turner clearly takes religion seriously, would suggest. By that I mean, when historians look at Turner's religiosity, when they look at the pamphlet as exemplifying Turner's religiosity, they tend to say, well, look, here is a religious mind that tells a story and kind of sprinkles it with biblical citations, biblical references. And there isn't really very much of an attempt made to understand what that structure of citation actually means. Instead, it's as if, well, you know, anybody who is religious is going to sprinkle biblical citations into what they say. What I wanted to do was to understand as closely as possible what that religious mentality actually meant. And so I took the structure of citation very seriously. And I was able, at least to my own satisfaction, to trace a very coherent religious ideology. An evangelical Christian ideology that drew to a very large extent on the Gospel of St. Luke and on the Book of Revelation in creating an account of Turner himself as ultimately the Redeemer return, the second coming of Christ. He does this in a way that is not at all indiscriminate. He is not pulling citations from different parts of the Bible kind of indiscriminately. He is creating a narrative of himself as a person whose faith matures over a period of time, who gains a deeper and deeper understanding of his own spirituality and of his own significance over time. Significance, that is, as a religious figure himself. And ultimately identifies himself as Christ returned. This is really part of the what I mean by a speculative history. I can't prove it. I can point to the structure of citation as evidence that this is a way of understanding the religious persona of Nat Turner in a coherent way, in quite a compelling way. But you know, as I said, it is a speculation, but it is a speculation grounded in the evidence that is available to me.
Yeah, that makes sense. And so getting back to the rebellion itself, you say in the book that the rebellion was not a straightforward murder spree, or it wasn't necessarily a straightforward revenge against slavery type of situation. So if it wasn't a murder spree, or if it wasn't strictly just mindless vengeance, what was this rebellion?
The rebellion is not one thing. I think the first comment I want to offer is by identifying it as a slave rebellion, we kind of categorize an event that is mysterious, and sort of all of a sudden we solved it because we've categorized it in a particular way. The rebellion is a number of different things, in my view. In part, it is fulfillment in Turner's mind of his role as the Redeemer returned. In the minds of others involved, I think it is more conventionally a form of revenge taken against particular slaveholding families. There are two very fine now. I mean, one of the things I should say is that the historiography, the history that has been written about the Turner Rebellion over the years, has often struck me as sort of somewhat disappointing compared, say, with a work on other slave rebellions or slave conspiracies, like Denmark Vesey's purported conspiracy, or Gabriel's rebellion. But recently, two very fine social histories have been written, published about the Turner Rebellion, which actually made my task, you know, rather easier, because it meant that there was a lot of research that I might otherwise have had to do that I didn't have to do because it had been done. But I think it's important, nevertheless, to say, you know, Nat Turner does not kind of sit down with a bunch of Confederates and say, let's have a slave rebellion. They have different motivations. They have different ideas as to what they are doing. As the event develops, as people join it, those others who join in have their own motivations for joining in, or in many cases, they join reluctantly, in some cases they are coerced, in other cases they will join for a short period and then sort of quietly disappear from the group. There are a number of just different reasons for this event to have occurred.
Okay. And one of the things, or one of the statements that you make in the book that I thought was really interesting is when we get towards the second half of the book, you mentioned that the rebellion is what you called an instance of counter-sovereignty. And what did you mean by that?
By counter-sovereignty, the suggestion is that what the rebellion does represent, however one analyzes the different motivations of those who are engaged in it, it represents a fundamental challenge to an existing order of authority. That is, of course, white authority, white social authority, cultural authority, political authority within the state of Virginia and indeed beyond it. But whatever one concludes about the motivations that bring this event into being, it is a challenge. And it's a challenge to a regime of authority. The major, whose reason for being is to control slaves. So that a group of slaves is uncontrolled, even for a relatively short period of time, makes it. This is what I mean by calling it an instance of counter-sovereignty. And when we look at the response to the rebellion, the response is one to reassert that sovereignty, that authority, as quickly as possible. So whether it is an assertion, whether the counter-sovereignty is the counter-sovereignty of Turner's sense of himself as an ultimate religious figure, as Christ, or whether it is the counter-sovereignty of his comrades who are expressing their newfound consciousness of themselves as self-acting people. The objective of authority is to reassert itself as quickly as possible, with whatever form of coercion is required to reassert that authority.
Your discussion of counter-sovereignty led into what I believe is the longest chapter of the book, which I believe is the last chapter before the epilogue. And in that chapter, you talk about how that sovereignty reasserted itself, but it wasn't a absolute or it was fast, but you pointed out in the book that there was that the Turner Rebellion kind of reopened or accelerated a debate among Southerners and Virginians about the morality of slavery, because some people made the argument that these uprisings, this is why slavery is bad, and so maybe we should outlaw it. And there were others who solidified kind of their defense of slavery. And ultimately, we know that the supporters of slavery won the debate. But I thought it was really interesting how that played out, is that there actually was a bit of a debate in the wake of the Turner Rebellion about the future of slavery in Virginia. And so at one point you said that you called Virginians vulnerable, fragile, and guilty sovereigns. So I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about how that debate played out, even if it was a relatively quick debate.
Sure. Virginia, politically, socially, Virginia in the 1820s, the period immediately prior to the Turner Rebellion, Virginia is really quite a divided state. There is old Tidewater Virginia. There is the Piedmont Virginia, into which Tidewater slaveholders have been expanding for the last 100 years. But in the West, what is now the separate state of West Virginia, but then was simply the western part of the single state of Virginia, you have migration in to that area and a very different kind of society being created, a society of pastoral farming and of subsistence farming that is mostly free of slaveholding. There are a few small pockets of slaveholding in Western Virginia, but the vast majority of Western Virginia is free of slavery. The state politically is controlled largely by the East, by Old Virginia, by Tidewater and Piedmont Virginia. And increasingly, the two sections of Virginia are at odds with each other because their economies are very different. They have different needs and demands to make of state government. And increasingly, the debate between the two sections focuses upon the focuses upon slavery itself. Slavery is what Eastern Virginia desires to defend. Its desire to defend its slaveholding leaves Easterners anxious to maintain their political ascendancy within the state. That political ascendancy within the state is what Westerners increasingly concentrate upon as an obstacle to the state meeting their own very different needs and demands. So gradually the state has become focused on the question of slavery over time. This is, you know, the white state has become focused on this question of slavery over time. To the point where a couple of years prior to the rebellion, constitutional convention is created to debate the whole question of suffrage and political representation, the redistribution of political power within the state, that redistributive effort essentially confirms the East once again as politically ascendant, so it doesn't resolve the growing political conflict between the sections. And after the rebellion, the question reemerges, and it reemerges with much more vigor and much more hostility between those in the East who wish to maintain their defense of slaveholding and those in the West who now identify the fact of slaveholding as the chief obstacle to their own development. This isn't really a debate over the morality of slaveholding as such. Western anti-slavery opinion is not in any sense sort of racially progressive. They want slavery banned from the state, but they also want to expel, they want to expel all the slaves too. So, the question that this debate occurs around is whether the institution of slavery shall be maintained within Virginia, or not.
Yes, that's an important point to remember, is that this was not abolitionism or a civil rights movement type moment. This was simply a economic debate over the usefulness of slavery more than anything else. Now, in your epilogue, you established what you're calling a constellation between Thomas Gray's Confessions of Nat Turner, Max Weber's Lecture on Science as a Vocation from 1917, and Walter Benjamin's essay on Capitalism as Religion from 1921. Can you tell us a bit more about that constellation? How did all of these sources work together to help you better understand the Nat Turner rebellion?
Well, I should say, first of all, that the book itself, I conceive of the book as a Benjaminian book. My own sense of history, my own philosophy of history is a Benjaminian philosophy of history, which is to say that, you know, the historical event is constructed in the now when we engage with it. We're not trying to recover something that has occurred, although indeed that something has occurred, but rather what we're examining is at least as much our own interest in that event. Why are we interested in that event at this particular moment when we come to recognize its appeal or its significance to ourselves at the moment that we engage with it? And so what I'm trying to do in creating that constellation in the epilogue is to say, we as observers, not simply as historians who are undertaking the research that renders history available to us, but also as readers engaging with this particular moment, we are actively creating rather than sort of passively receiving. And what we're creating is our own consciousness of meaning, the meaning of the event, but also the meaning that it has for us in the moment in which we consider it. So the idea of a constellation is, if you think of it sort of astrologically, or you think of it astronomically, constellations of stars in the sky do not exist as such. We can look at the sky and we can see, you know, the Great Bear, or we can see Orion. And these are patterns of pinpoints of light that humanity has, on which humanity has imposed figural meaning. But those stars do not have any relationship to each other in that form. We create those patterns through our own observation. We impose those figural representations on the patterns that we see. In the same way, we as observers are the creators of the patterns that we see in the material that we interact with. So what I'm pointing out in the book, or in the epilogue, is the importance of sort of understanding that the reader, the author, is taking a position in offering an interpretation, in offering a meaning. We are actively engaged in a process of creating history rather than sort of passively receiving it. And the equivalent to that that astronomical pattern is the series of texts that we bring into a relationship with each other in order to try to understand the event or the occurrence in which we are interested. I turned to Weber and to Benjamin as texts that could be brought into conjunction with Gray's text, and that I, as the creator, the observer, can use to interpret Gray's text. Weber is significant because that extraordinary essay, Science as a Vocation, is the source of one of Weber's greatest and most fascinating pronouncements about modernity, which is what he calls its disenchantment. That is, the world is disenchanted. And by that he means that we have ceased over time to rely upon a sense of mystery or myth or magic to understand the world about us. That instead, we become aware of our capacity to know empirically the world. And that is, in developing that knowledge, we disenchant the world. We render it less mysterious. And I find that significant in this particular instance because, in my view, that is precisely what Gray is doing in his pamphlet. He is engaged in a process of explanation that, of rational explanation that produces something that all his neighbors and his audience in that pamphlet can recognize. He produces a slave rebellion. Of course, it's something that Southerners have been anxious about or are anxious about, but nevertheless, it's something that they can recognize. It's something that has a certain familiarity to them. And one can think of the pamphlet as a kind of relentless exercise in the production of something that is recognizable, the slave rebellion, that is devoid of mystery. That's why, in my own analysis of the pamphlet, I counterpose the two parts, the part in which Turner is speaking autobiographically about himself, about which Gray, first of all, doesn't know any of that stuff before, and I believe he's not particularly interested in that stuff. What he's interested in is figuring out, you know, exactly what happened when, creating a pattern for himself and for his readers, something that they can recognize. So that's the reason that I appeal to Weber, as one point in the constellation that I'm creating. I use Benjamin's Capitalism as Religion because it is itself just a fragment. It's less than 1,000 words of almost jotting in which Benjamin is exploring what is religion and what is capitalism, and how are they interrelated? And because part of the explanation of Southern response to the rebellion that I develop in that long final substantive chapter that you refer to, the sixth chapter of the book, which is about the political conflict between the two sections of Virginia, but it's also about how that conflict is resolved. And it is resolved in the manner of leaving the question of slavery to the market, leaving the question of Virginia's own economy, not to, and slavery as an institution within that economy, not to political determination, but simply to the necessary development of political economy. And so what one sees in the rebellion, what I see in the rebellion, the rebellion is not an overtly kind of anti-capitalist movement. That would be stupid to make that claim. But what one sees in the aftermath of the rebellion is the clarification of what kind of economy Virginia has and how that economy should be left to operate for itself, rather than attempting to mess with it with attempts at sort of political abolition of an economic institution, the institution of slavery. And someone has, you know, this extraordinary juxtaposition between, on the one hand, the religious figure of Turner as the, as I've described him, conceiving of himself as the Redeemer returned, and on the other, the kind of the profane response to the event in which that is, in which Turner makes that sense of himself plain, the profane response is to say, well, political economy will cure all our ills. Political economy is the way in which we address the question of slavery within the state of Virginia. So the component elements of the epilogue, the constellation that I am kind of trying to assemble in the epilogue as my way of explaining or interpreting what Nat Turner and his rebellion, how we can think about it, all of the elements of the constellation that I am assembling are intended to show how, by juxtaposing these different texts, one can arrive at an intelligent appraisal of of this person, Turner, and of his rebellion, of an appraisal of the matter of Nat Turner.
Great, and I think that's a good place to end the discussion of the book. I've taken up a lot of your time here, but what is next for you now that you're done with this project?
Yeah, I've begun to think about that. I'm going to do something completely different again. Although I say it's completely different, but in a way, it's a return to interests that I had many years ago. The first book I ever wrote was called The State and the Unions, and it was a study of the history of labor relations law and of the development of state-favored collective bargaining during the New Deal. And for anybody who has any interest in labor law or in the labor movement in this country, anybody who has those interests will know that the organized labor movement in the United States currently is about as weak as it's ever been at any point in the last 150 years. And much of my interest currently lies in returning to the question of the relationship between the structure of labor relations law as it exists in the United States and the current state of the labor movement as it exists in the United States. So it's something completely different than writing about Nat Turner and his rebellion. I can't really say that I can think of some particular reason why I chose to make this move, except that, like Turner, it's something that really interests me. And it's something that I know something about, and hopefully something that I can contribute to.
Yeah, and Will, whatever your reason for it, I look forward to seeing what you do next. So thank you for taking the time to talk to me about Nat Turner today, Dr. Tomlin.
Thank you very much indeed. I enjoyed the opportunity.
I've been talking to Christopher Tomlins about his new book, In the Matter of Nat Turner, A Speculative History. You've been listening to New Books in History on the New Books Network.